WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work.
Chicago City Council dukes it out over a property tax hike and the return of two beloved hot dog statues. A news cycle like that can only mean one thing. It's time for the weekly news recap. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset.
Mayor Johnson calling an audible tonight, walking back his proposal for a massive $300 million property tax hike to balance the budget.
For the first time, voters cast ballots for members of the school board.
But with the mayor's proposed budget cuts to the Office of Constitutional Policing, reform goals could become even more challenging.
Here to help make sense of the week's news, we had Chicago reporter with Axios, Carrie Shepard, political correspondent for Fox 32, Paris Schutz, and government and politics reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times, Mitchell Armentrout. And we started off with the city's budget challenges. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson's massive tax hike did not make it past city council. Paris filled us in.
Nothing's going right here, Sachin, for the mayor. You know, first of all, let's go way back to the campaign where he says, I'm the one candidate that promises not to raise your property taxes. Well, I guess that's going to be true now. But then he proposes a $300 million property tax hike. It's dead on arrival. Majority of city council members don't like it. And so they schedule this vote to basically vote it down. And the thing is, he had acknowledged a few days ago, as you played that clip, that it was dead on arrival. And he started negotiating alternatives.
Yeah.
So it's stunning that this meeting even took place. I mean, it's a huge rebuke to him.
Yeah, you said they voted it down. I mean, let's
50
be clear.
To nothing.
Unanimously.
But he already knew that it was dead on arrival. He already pulled it off the table, and he was already trying to negotiate with Alders on an alternative. And so now you get this big headline in the front page of the Sun-Times saying 50-0. You know, it doesn't look very good. And the mayor's trying to spin it as, well, it's a new day in City Hall because we're going to collaborate.
Mm.
And City Council's not used to that. And there's going to be some growing pains here. That's a stretch.
Yeah. Because
there's many Alders that say, well, he's not collaborating with me. He hasn't met with me on this. So, I think there's a breakdown here in the political part of this where, you know, he should have found a way to have that meeting never happen.
Well, let's hear from the mayor himself. This is where he was asked by reporters to respond to that aldermanic pushback.
Well, I don't necessarily consider it as pushback. I'll say it like this. So as a public school teacher, sometimes we do things to get people's attention. And so now that we have the attention of everyone, I've said from the very beginning, this is a proposal. I'm a collaborative mayor.
What do you think, Carrie? Was that $300 million, was it just a number that he was floating out there just to maybe get their reaction?
Well, I think the budget always gets, or it should always get, all everyone's attention. I don't think a $300 million property tax maybe is. I know that the mayor's collaborator in chief, that's his thing he's been throwing around. And let's be clear, this doesn't mean that property taxes are completely off the table. We have to fill this budget gap some way.
Right.
And, you know, some aldermen have come up with alternatives. There's, you know, I think there's been like a raising your garbage fee, for example, stuff like that, regressive tax. But $300 million, that was probably not going to fly, especially with some of the mayor's biggest critics like Brendan Riley, who is a downtown, you know, he represents the Loop. Those are higher property prices down in the Loop,
right,
which means their property taxes are going to be even higher on
right.
average. They said it was going to go up $300 if you had a $350,000 house. Well, you're going to pay a lot more if you live in the Loop, if you live in Gold Coast, et cetera. So, yeah, that probably was never going to fly with them anyway. And we should be clear that most budgets, by the there's a lot of hand-wringing, in this time, but like when it comes down to it, aldermen vote for the budget. But when it's Mayor Emanuel, Paris and Mitch, they know this. When it's Mayor Emanuel, when it's Daley, they do a lot of this behind closed doors. It's just that this is happening out in the open, and that does not look great.
Yeah, I want to hear from you, Mitch. I mean, does the mayor wanting to collaborate, does that ring true to you?
I think in some sense he does have a point that, this is sort of the negotiations that have been going on behind closed doors for generations. I think that's also a pretty convenient PR spin. But in some respects, when you have 50 aldermen voting against what he says was a painful but necessary move to fund a budget, it kind of puts the ball in their court to say, okay, let's figure out some ideas to make this happen. And we really haven't seen many ideas that are going to cover this huge budget gap next year. I mean, there's a proposal floated yesterday by Alderman William Hall to tax hemp products, so like Delta 8.
Yeah.
Again, that's not going to put together billions of dollars. Certainly not, in the next less than 2 months that Brandon Johnson has to get a budget passed. I think, the clock is now really ticking.
Well, yeah, and Kerry brought up a great point. It's like, a mayor has to have a seasoned political team around them to keep score. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that the mayor didn't know beforehand that this $300 million property tax hike was not going to get a support, you're supposed to know that.
Right.
So that you avoid sort of this kind of stepping on the rake, and all of this being aired out in public. All right, I propose this. Oh, gosh, I'm going to get defeated. I think there's some dysfunction in his office in terms of the folks on his political team.
Yeah.
And older people are saying we don't really even interact with them. They don't have a lot of they don't have relationships with us. So it goes down to sort of dysfunction all around in his office.
Right. Are you hearing of any other options or other taxes that Johnson might consider to bring in revenue?
Yeah, well, Mitch mentioned the Delta 8, which is, it's just an unregulated product. It's not legal or illegal. It's just unregulated. These Delta 8 drinks, I agree it's not going to bring in $300 million. They are talking this. They brought up the notion of tax on cloud computing companies. It's going to be revenue, though. Whatever it is, it's not going to be cuts because the mayor did say, I will not cut any jobs or issue any furloughs.
So, Mitch, the mayor was reminded how hard it is to cut budgets when he targeted the police department. What is the mayor thinking of doing?
Right. So, obviously, there's been a lot of controversy around Brandon Johnson and this idea of whether he would try to defund the police department. Actually, next year's budget and his proposal, the police department budget increases slightly, but that's mostly just due to police union raises that are required. But he did try to make some cuts in the police department's reform office. Mm-hmm. Obviously, CPD has been under a consent decree from the U.S. Department of Justice for more than 4 years, 4 to 5 years.
Yeah.
And basically, this latest budget, he's trying to cut the cost there by about 45% in this Office of Reform, which currently has a $6.7 million budget. His proposal would bring that down to 3.7.
Mm-hmm.
And it would there's 65 workers there right now. He wants to relocate some of those folks to other positions to bring it down to 28 positions. And this has immediately drawn some pushback from city's monitor, who's kind of overseeing the police department.
They're saying this is a huge blow to police reform efforts.
Exactly. And even Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul has sent a letter to the mayor urging him to, hey, you need to rethink this because you're going to face some serious reprimands in court if you try to scale back any of this progress, which, again, by the end of last year, CPD was only 7% in compliance with this consent decree. So obviously a lot more work to be done.
And isn't that amazing? I mean, this is a progressive mayor.
Yeah.
Police reform is a big deal to him, and to wield the axe at that part of the CPD budget is pretty stunning. And Kwame Raoul, the attorney general, literally said, "I have grave concerns." He's serious that this is going to be problematic.
I mean, talk about an identity crisis for the mayor in terms of the fact that he had to push back against concerns from people who said that he was saying defund the police. This is a progressive mayor who was elected by progressives,
mm-hmm.
and to cut the reform when we you know, we are far behind on the consent decree. And as, you know, AG Raul says, look, you could be in contempt of court if you cut these.
Yeah.
So that's a real issue.
Yeah. All right. Let's turn to CPS, Chicago Public Schools. Drama on Tuesday when school CEO Pedro Martinez showed up at City Hall, Mitch.
Right. So there was a meeting where he presented basically the situation facing seven schools, mostly on the southwest side, in the Acero Charter School Network, which announced last month that they want to shut down seven schools, which essentially leaves about 2,000 kids with an unclear future on where they're going to be heading to school.
Almost not good.
300 teachers without future positions lined up.
Mm-hmm.
And, a lot of Mayor Brandon Johnson's allies are setting this up as, they say that CPS CEO Pedro Martinez has not got a plan in place for these kids to land and for these educators to land. So there was a marathon school board meeting last night where, frankly, not yes. a heck of a lot of movement happened on this exact topic. But obviously this drama between Brandon Johnson and his CTU allies trying to force out Pedro Martinez, this seems to just be ratcheting up by the week.
Yeah. Well, let's hear from the rest of you all. What do you think? I mean, does it seem clear the mayor still wants to get rid of Martinez?
Yeah. The mayor and CTU. And it's very clear that this Acero charter school issue, they are trying to use that as pretext to fire Martinez because he has to be fired for cause. Or else they have to give him 6 month notice. So it's a big stretch to say that this is somehow a sufficient cause to fire Martinez. And the interesting thing is last night at this meeting, the Martinez and school officials were going to present, their contingency plans, and they got shot down by the board. The board didn't even want to hear them. And then they went into closed session. So
why do you think that happened?
I don't know. I mean, you could guess this because they don't want to make him look competent. You wonder where the orders are coming from to the board. But it's quite clear that because Pedro Martinez said no to this $300 million loan, and CTU and Mayor Johnson want him gone, and all this chaos at the school board and CPS is because of that.
Mm.
And it's just really bad dysfunction at the top.
Yeah, let's back up even more that this story makes very odd, strange bedfellows in the fact that CTU and charters usually are not allies, but in the sense Acero teachers are in the CTU. So CTU really wants to protect, as they should, their union members, which teach at Acero schools. These
right.
are like majority Latino schools. And, school closures are, of course, a very big deal. So they have, they are targeting Martinez, and, the board is saying, look, and it's not even clear that CPS can do anything legally to keep the charter schools open, which mm-hmm. are privately run with public funds. So to use that, I mean, the cynical part of me is like, we're wagering these schools and closed schools and 2,000 kids and families.
Yeah.
All for a personnel issue, which the mayor, often says, I don't talk about personnel issues, is just creating more chaos for the school board right now, which is the last thing it needs.
And this is happening when we just had elections
right.
for a school board,
right.
the first elected school board, hybrid
yes.
school board, and they're going to take their seat in January. So, and some of them wrote a letter saying,
right.
don't make any big moves until we get on board. And I asked the mayor about that, and he said, we're not going to wait.
Yeah, quote from the actual letter, do not take actions that would alter finances, staff, curriculum, strategic plans, or contracts. I mean, that covers just
that
about
covers
everything.
About everything, but the mayor said no. We get to, I said, should they make lame duck moves like this? The parents aren't lame duck. The teachers aren't lame duck. The kids aren't lame duck. So no, they got to take. So he wants this interim lame duck board to do something.
I mean, was there anything that they could do at yesterday's meeting?
No.
Well, the Chalkbeat reported that the presentation that Martinez had did present some alternatives for
okay.
these students, which would be like CPS, takes these kids in. There was some sort of vague thing of like, we help with the finances, but there wasn't any sort of actual solution. So, I mean, that was supposedly in this presentation, but
yeah,
beyond that, not sure.
We had two of those newly elected school board members here on Reset on Monday, Angel Gutierrez, who is backed by a coalition supporting charter schools, and Ebony DeBerry, who's a former Chicago public school teacher backed by the teachers union. They had different visions for Chicago schools, of course, so I want to just play a little bit of what they had to say on the show.
Charter schools our public schools, right? They get public dollars, right, from the pot. So wanting to make sure that every student, that every parent has an opportunity to send their kids to where they're going to be the most successful.
Schools are being resourced that don't necessarily have to follow any regulations or guidelines of the public school system, and, you know, how that really doesn't increase our value system among who our students are.
So, Carrie, you know, a lot of people with these races were also surprised by the amount of money spent here. I mean, how did it turn out overall?
I mean, I think it was sometimes reported, I think close to like $7 million or something.
A lot of money poured in.
Yeah,
here.
And it was kind of not seen as a big win for either the CTU or the other thing, school choice advocates, which was, you know, the Illinois Network of Charter Schools backed kind of the other, you know, candidates that weren't backed by CTU. But there were candidates who were backed by either side. And two of them actually ended up winning races that were not called on election night. That was in District 9 and District 10.
Nice.
District 10 was Che Rhymefest. We may know.
Che Rhymefest Smith?
Yes, Rhymefest is well known, especially on WBZ. He's been on quite many times.
Friend of the show, for
friend
sure.
Friend of the show, rapper,
great
performer,
producer.
Co-wrote Jesus Walks.
Yes, he did.
Friend of Kanye.
Yes, and that district is down
maybe
on...
Maybe ex-friend.
That goes a long way in Chicago, though.
I think still friends. So that 10th district is Kenwood, Hyde Park, Woodlawn, and then Therese Boyle in the 9th was called as well. Chicago Lawn, West Englewood, Chatham. And then in the 1st district, that was the other race that hadn't been called on
election.
Do we
have a winner yet?
Yeah, the Michelle Pierre conceded to Jennifer Custer, who was backed by the CTU.
Oh, okay.
That's a far northwest side district, which would be like Dunning, Jefferson Park, Norwood Park. But Jennifer Custer was a CTU-backed candidate.
With the election behind us, Illinois politicians are strategizing on how they'll move forward under a second Trump administration. I began by asking about Governor Pritzker. What's he doing? Here's Paris.
Well, I mean, he's meeting with legislators right now to talk about legislation they can call in the veto session on issues like abortion, see if they need to strengthen anything, worker protections, union protections. But he started this group called Governors Safeguarding Democracy with Colorado Governor Jared Polis, basically. I don't know specifically that much about what their plans are, other than it's going to be blue state governors, although he says that he's going to get some Republican governors too. He's talking about coming together to sort of protect against potential authoritarian overreach. And, you know, it's quick. He's jumping on this very quickly. He's kind of leading the vanguard here nationally as the anti-Trump. It could be because he has political aspirations in 2028, but it also could be because if you just go based on what Trump said or what Project 2025 said, there are serious threats here that perhaps if you're a more Democratic-minded politician, you have to heed. You know, how is it going to work when the new Tom Homan, the new border czar, says we're going to come in and deport, do mass deportations, whether you cooperate with us or not? Well, Illinois is a welcoming state, Chicago's a sanctuary city, and the law says local law enforcement can't cooperate with federal law enforcement. So how is that going to play out? There's probably going to be legal tussles. And I'm just going to tell your listeners, you know, for the folks that voted here and said, well, now we're done with politics and we can go back to our normal lives, nothing's going to be normal.
It's only just begun.
It hasn't even begun. It's 2 months till he takes office.
Correct.
It's going to be nothing but contention.
Yeah, well, let's hear a little bit from Governor Pritzker himself, and then I'll get some more of your thoughts on the back end.
Each governor has good ideas that are worth sharing across state lines with one another about how to safeguard our states from what we think might be an onslaught from the federal government to take powers away from the states and or to actually violate the Constitution.
So, Mitch, does it seem like Pritzker's positioning himself, like Paris said, to be this national leader with the within the opposition during the second Trump term?
Yeah, absolutely. And he's been kind of positioning himself that way for years, you could argue. I mean, Illinois has obviously been.
And then we keep speculating, oh, he's going to make a run in 2024. Mm-hmm. Now Paris says 2028.
We thought he was going to be a VP candidate, right?
True. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's only going to escalate more in the years ahead, you think. But yeah, Illinois, obviously a bastion for abortion rights. A lot of other progressive policies, legalizing marijuana before a lot of other states. Really strong union protections. And yeah, I mean, he obviously, Pritzker was a very prominent surrogate for Kamala Harris during her candidacy. He's really tried to be like the watchdog or the attack dog, I guess, for Democrats. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that in the months ahead. But like you said, I mean, I think it's going to come down to exactly how contentious things are going to get with the Trump administration. You know, wouldn't see exactly how much they want to interfere with a lot of the laws that are already in place.
There are so many things to keep watch for.
And is Illinois going to pay the price? Because, you know, if you get on Trump's bad side, if you're a critic of him, he's going to retaliate. Is it going to be drying up federal funds for infrastructure or things? The governor said, look, there's a lot of those things that are nonpartisan, nonpolitical, and the Department of Transportation or other federal agencies, those things are already signed off on. So he doesn't think it's going to cost Illinois, but whew, I mean,
it just might.
It just might.
Yeah, Illinois' Democratic senators voicing their concerns as well. Tammy Duckworth spoke out against Trump's choice for Secretary of Defense, Fox News host Pete Hegseth. Carrie, what did Duckworth have to say?
How embarrassing. Not her. I'm saying him.
Oh, this is what Carrie Shepherd had to say.
I mean, he said something about women being in combat, that they shouldn't be in combat. Yep. And she, understandably, justifiably, and correctly said, how do you think I lost my legs? Because she's an Iraq war veteran and she lost both of her legs. This is someone who led the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs. This was an assistant
awarded
secretary.
Awarded a Purple Heart.
Yeah, in the U.S., you know, Department of Veterans Affairs. You know, Trump is, I don't know if my vision's been clouded in the last week, but I don't remember like all these cabinet appointments being handed out like a deck of cards, you know, like dealing a deck of cards so quickly.
And so quickly, yes.
So quickly. And perhaps arbitrarily, but
I feel like, what, four times a day we hear breaking news.
A new one.
Well, you know, I mean, the number one attribute that he wants them to have, loyalty to Trump.
Loyalty.
No objective person could look at some of these picks and say, this is the most qualified person when it comes to keeping the country safe, when it comes to running a major bureaucracy. Absolutely not. Matt Gates, of course not.
That was a shocker.
It's loyalty to Trump.
I make the point, and of course, with Duckworth, who is a sitting senator and had all those appointments for Veterans Affairs and is an actual veteran, and I think Hegseth is as well, perhaps. I don't know.
Yes, he's an Army veteran.
Yeah, he's an Army veteran. So I just like, I mean, what else can you say about that? It's just absurd that he would say that.
Senator Dick Durbin says last week's election, giving Republicans control of the Senate, that could impact whether he seeks re-election. So your thoughts, Paris, on what is ahead for Illinois' senior senator?
Well, he comes off of a very powerful post. You know, they were in the majority. He's chairman of the Judiciary Committee, which is a plum post. You run all these hearings for, you know, court appointees, whether it gets to the Supreme Court or not, appellate courts, and he gets to help sort of the president fill the benches with people that they want that are ideologically aligned. Now you go into the minority, he's going to have no power, he's pushing 80 years old. I don't think that's going to be a very fun place for him to be, and it's going to be the Trump show nonstop. You know, I can't see him wanting to run again.
Yeah, you're right. And he turns 80 next week, actually.
Yeah, 80 next week. Happy premature birthday to the senator. And I just don't see what's in it for him to keep going. And it'll set off a mad dash in Illinois. There are many people that want that seat. And they're already positioning themselves.
But it's like, does Pritzker go for that? I mean, I wouldn't think you'd go governor to senator. I think governor is a more powerful position. Yeah. What do you think?
I agree.
Yeah.
Governor of a state? Yeah, for sure.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Governor of a state. Yeah. I mean, I think there are people like Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy.
Yes. Okay.
He's trying to position himself. But then you've got, you know, very ambitious people like Alexei Janulius,
Who has run for senator before.
Who's run before. And pretty much, I would say a handful of our Democratic Congress people will want to run for that job.
Yeah.
So the The knives will be out.
As was alluded to earlier, Illinois lawmakers, they're back in Springfield. This is for the fall legislative session, Mitch. Democrats, of course, strategizing about how they're going to deal with the Trump administration. Talk about what they're prioritizing.
Right. We just ended this week. Lawmakers were down in Springfield Tuesday through Thursday. Really didn't move a heck of a lot of bills. Certainly not major ones that are targeted towards the second Trump administration. But talking to House Speaker Chris Welch last week, he said that basically they're taking this time to sort of evaluate what they might need to shore up. Illinois obviously already has some of the most pro-abortion rights legislation on the books of any state in the mm-hmm. country. But my colleague Violet Miller spoke with State Rep. Kelly Cassidy from the North Side, who's really kind of the state's leader when it comes to reproductive rights. And she said basically that what they might focus on, they've got two sessions before Trump is inaugurated. They'll come back in January. They're looking at data privacy protections. There's some concern in circles about folks being tracked with apps on their phones, using location services as they go to different health centers, and then potentially folks out of state where certain healthcare is illegal, punishing those folks there that way. So,
interesting.
Again, like pretty in the weeds stuff, but it's, you know, this, they're really looking at any sort of way to sort of prevent any further crackdowns.
Some are also considering how to protect LGBTQ rights that could be at risk with a Trump administration. Abortion, Mitch, I mean, is ensuring access to abortion and reproductive rights in Illinois, that's on their agenda as well?
Yeah, I think they're going to look at ways to shore that up. One thing that I'm interested in is, you know, for all of the legislation that J.B. Pritzker and other really progressive state reps and senators have passed over the last 6 years, there's no amendment to the state constitution that protects those rights by the Constitution. And that would have to go through an entire vote before voters in the next election. And I'm curious if there's any sort of sense of regret among lawmakers for not doing that. The line of thought from Governor Pritzker has been that he's funded efforts in other states to enshrine abortion rights in state constitutions. So it was sort of a not really a priority here. But, you know, that could, if a federal ban is passed, that could come into play.
You never know.
Do we not have trigger laws? A trigger law?
We had a trigger law in place when Roe v. Wade was overturned.
Okay.
But as far as like the actual, you know, having it in the state constitution.
I see.
That's okay. That's the difference.
Yeah, I'm really concerned about, you know, all the pressure. You know, Illinois is the state where the most out-of-state people come for abortion care. And we have, you know, especially clinics in southern Illinois. The demand is so high.
Yeah.
And it's like the concern of, you know, the healthcare professionals there, the funding there.
Resources
mm-hmm. is just the demand. It's, you know, I'm really concerned about what kind of resources they're going to have.
Yeah, no, I share that concern. Were they also talking, Mitch, about the potential merger of public transit agencies? Did that come up?
You know, that's something that they've been talking about for months, and it's certainly not something that's going to be figured out the next week or even probably in January. Like you said, there's this fiscal cliff facing basically every transit agency in the state, and no one really knows exactly what to do about it. There's obviously a pretty big push from among some state legislators to merge all the agencies who don't want that to happen for a variety of different reasons.
Right.
So I think that's probably, we're going to be looking well into 2025 before any sort of substantive moves might happen there.
So in his first remarks about the presidential election, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson addressed what Republicans have promised will be the, quote, largest domestic deportation operation in American history. What did Mayor Johnson say about that, Paris?
Well, that the city's not going to change its laws of being a sanctuary city. And
is this where he said, we will not bend?
We will not bend, right. So, again, what that means is that when federal immigration agents come in, local law enforcement is not going to cooperate with them. They're not going to say, okay, well, you know, we took in this person for this misdemeanor and we learned that they're not an actual resident. They're undocumented. And here you go. Here's all their info. They can't do that.
Mm.
Now, in the first Trump administration, the same issue was at play. And the Trump administration tried to retaliate by withholding public safety grants, federal public safety grants. Mayor Rahm Emanuel at the time sued and won, saying that you cannot withhold that money just because the city is a sanctuary city. So we'll see how that, you know, though, that that's not going to stop whoever the attorney general is and President Trump from tried to punish the state for being sanctuary, the city for being a sanctuary city, and saying, get out of the way. We need to conduct our deportation. So also, I have to say, like, it's very unclear how this is even going to work, how mass deportations are going to work. It's going to cost tens of billions of dollars, A. B, now they're saying, well, we're just going to start with the most violent criminals. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you're a violent criminal, it's not as if you're being protected now. So, you know, let's see how much of this was PR on the campaign trail and how much of this can actually be enacted as policy. I will remind listeners that from the Libertarian Cato Institute, Trump got an F for the border and for he had conducted fewer deportations under his watch than President Obama.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So for the folks that say
Obama still holds the record.
Yeah. Obama holds it. The deporter in chief, they called him.
Yeah.
Trump did not. He did not succeed in the things that he says that he's going to succeed at. So,
but he says he will instruct federal agents to conduct deportation operations at schools, churches, and playgrounds.
And this
can
is where
the city stop
this
him?
This is where we're going to see. This is going to be a major front in this battle between states and the federal government if there tries to be overreach. And I think that can the city stop him? Can the state? I don't think we know anything, Sasha.
I don't think so either.
You know, we're entering the unknown.
Give me the answers.
One of the resolutions passed by the Board of Education, in addition to Sarah, was protecting students that you know from
should something like this be threatened again.
Incredibly important. I mean, not a resolution like Paris says. What does a resolution do when the federal government comes in? But incredibly important when we have tens of thousands of thousands of kids that came in that are some of whom are seeking asylum from dangerous governments.
And let's remind, like, President Trump in his first term before he changed his message was actually in favor of DACA and the Dream. He said, I remember him saying, you know, these kids came here through no fault of their own.
So I hardly remember that.
They shouldn't
that
be
must
punished.
Have been like day one.
But then the immigration hardliners said, you can't say that and be a Republican now. So,
yeah.
And Homan is saying, well, we'll just deport everybody, even though there might be kids that are born here that are legal residents, but their parents are undocumented. So you're just going to deport everybody?
Mm.
Again, ACLU, they're probably getting their fundraising ready because they're going to be very busy.
Yeah.
A lot of legal groups are going to be very busy.
And here's the thing. At the same time as these threats to deport undocumented immigrants were being made, Trump made gains with Latino voters here. And you covered the story, Mitch. Tell us more.
Right. It's kind of interesting. It's sort of on his face. It seems like you would think that voting for Trump sort of for a lot of Latino communities, that might be voting against your own interests. But my colleague Emmanuel Camarillo and I, we talked to some voters in different parts of the city where Trump actually made pretty significant gains among voters. Obviously, Chicago, deeply blue, won the vast majority of all precincts, most precincts in the city. But he made some headway in, in areas like Brighton Park, out near Midway, even parts of Little Village, predominantly Hispanic neighborhoods.
Bridgeport,
exactly, yeah. It's a lot of the times we're talking about a difference of, you know, Trump losing by 70 or 80 points in 2020 to losing by 60 or 55 points this time. But still, I mean, a significant enough statistical switch. So Manny and I, we talked to some voters in these parts, and essentially it comes down to what it comes down to for folks from all ethnic backgrounds,
right.
And that's the economy.
Yeah.
We talked to voters who just
voting with their pocketbooks.
They trust Trump more when it comes to economic issues. They said they didn't really hear a clear message from Kamala Harris on how she could help them get better jobs, get better resources in their community.
Trump had a clear message, broke it down, saying, hey, look, things are expensive right now. I'm going to fix it.
But even on the immigration issue, I think that Latinos aren't there. I got an email from someone saying, hey, these new migrant arrivals, these asylum seekers, they're getting free housing and they're getting food. And my family came here and we had to struggle. We didn't get anything.
We did the quote unquote right
way. We did it quote unquote the right way. Even if they didn't do it the right way, I think that
they're not a monolith.
They're not a monolith.
Absolutely.
I hate to bring in, just ethnicity into this, but you know, the vast majority of Chicago's Latino community is Mexican-American. The vast majority of the recent arrivals are Venezuelan. So for the Democratic Party to think, well, we're going to secure the Latino vote by being a sanctuary city and being, pro-immigrants coming in and all that, and to think that was going to secure
all the
Latino vote.
You're talking to
very different subsections of people, and
yeah.
I don't think the party understood that.
Yeah. I just had to check in on the corruption trial of former House Speaker Michael Madigan. Defense attorneys were picking apart the credibility of a government mole this week. I asked Paris to tell us about Fidel Marquez.
Well, Fidel Marquez was a former high-level executive at ComEd who, as you said, cooperated with the government, not only in this case, but in the previous case that brought down ComEd executives, although that case might be in they're going to retry that case. So the defense is basically trying to discredit him, saying you can't trust this guy. He's got personal indiscretions and, he's going to get off scot-free here. Well, my client is in a lot of trouble. So that's what's going on right now. But if we back up and take a big look at this. Like, this is 11 weeks that this. I went to a couple of days of testimony, and I'm looking at this jury sitting here taking in all of this information about how Madigan ran things, and then how ComEd works, and how power works, and how the Illinois Commerce Commission and rates, and how you're setting rates, and I just like can see their eyes glaze over.
Mean like mine right now?
Yes. Sorry, Sasha Ann. All right, I'll try to wrap this up. So my only point is the decision by prosecutors to make this such a long, expansive case and get into the nitty gritty to help paint this picture. Will that lead to a conviction or will it lead to a hung jury? Remember in the first Blagojevich trial, it was a hung jury and they had to simplify the case. It was just too complicated. So what we're trying to do here is they're just trying to just paint this big picture of how Madigan ran things in Springfield.
Well, I'll have more for you next Friday on the recap. Apparently. Okay, let's leave politics finally and turn to sports. The Chicago Bears continue to push for a new stadium site. Now, this time they're looking south to a familiar site, Mitch. You and I talked about
allegedly.
You and I talked about this earlier on Reset, Mitch, earlier this week. Tell us what's going on.
So the Bears are now taking another look at the Michael Reese Hospital site, which
allegedly
is down on the north end of Bronzeville, 31st Street, in the lakefront, basically. This is a site that folks have talked about for years and years for a number of different purposes, among them stadiums for various sports teams. The team previously said that it's too narrow to fit a stadium there. There's a rail line that goes through it. There's some toxic chemicals in the land that's going to require some remediation. So there's some things working against it, but the Bears basically have struck out with all their other top picks when it comes to the lakefront stadium proposal near Soldier Field. They're in a property tax dispute out in the northwest suburbs, Arlington Heights. So, there's some potential potentially more palatable ideas here. You know, it's a neighborhood that needs some investment. This is a property that's, sat there vacant for more than 20 years. There's some thought that maybe this is a proposal that the Bears could get some state legislative support behind for some public dollars.
Yeah. Well, how's the governor responding?
First of all, he says that, until the Bears actually show a proposal here, there's not really much to talk about, which for the record, the Bears have not confirmed that they're looking at this, but we've heard from pretty reliable sources that they're thinking long and hard about it. And essentially what the governor said is that, unless you can prove that there are really broad public benefits to a project, you're not going to get any state money for it. So once we get a better idea of exactly what they're asking for, we'll see what they could ask.
Man, just stay at Soldier Field.
Well, I was just there last week. It's, it's tough to get to. And then when the product on the field is nothing.
Right. Yeah.
Michael Reese is a fascinating site. And the developers, Farpoint developer, led by a guy named Scott Goodman, who's got a lot of developments that are intertwined in a lot of things. They want them there. And so much so that they came up with their own plans and renderings that they've kept secret that people are afraid to send out to reporters. Hint, hint. If you got it, leak it to me or Mitch or Carrie. But anyway, or Sasha Ann.
Yes.
Anyway.
And then I'll send it to you.
I think the Bears dropped the ball, though, and I think the time might have run out, because if they had come forward with the Michael Reese plans 6 months ago or a year ago, because there is legitimate benefit to the community, possibly, if you build here, not on the lakefront. There isn't. And if they might have had the state play ball, but now you've got the governor coming out saying we have a $3 billion budget deficit we're dealing with next year.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anything is going to get them to give the Bears any kind of subsidies. And I interviewed House Speaker Welch this week saying, stadium is not something we're talking about. We're talking about the economy, and we would be committing political suicide if we talked about subsidies for billionaire sports ownership. The Bears, they dropped the ball on this, and they're going to have to find some other benefit that that governments can provide that's not just tax giveaways? Like if it's, you know, building roads, building infrastructure, yes, the state will help with that. The city might help with that. But they're going to have to come out and say, by the way, we need a couple billion dollars and the hotel tax. You know,
well, this is not Pritzker's fight right now.
No.
It's not at all
on his agenda.
And as Paris already said, the performance on the field is frustrating. Or would you use another word?
I would use a couple words you can't say on radio.
Family show.
Yes, that's not sports radio, so I'll do my sports radio call-in shtick. How many times are Bears fans just going to deal with this? Now the offensive coordinator's fired, and the head coach is on the hot seat.
Well, tell us more. So you're talking about Shane Waldron.
Shane Waldron, he got let go because the Bears' offense has been so bad.
I mean, was there a surprise there, Mitch, at all?
No. I mean, someone's head had to roll. But, I mean, like Paris said, I mean, this is just, it's just deja vu because it's a nonstop cycle that the Bears find themselves in where you draft a promising young quarterback, things don't go very well. They go terribly, to put it mildly. And then, you know, is it the head coach's fault or is it the general manager's fault? So, you know, at this point, it seems like the head coach is probably the next one to go. If the next guy doesn't find a way to work with Caleb Williams, is it the general manager?
So you drafted Caleb Williams, this generational talent, with the first pick, and you entrusted his development to Matt Eberflus and Shane Waldron. I mean, that's got to be on the general manager, Ryan Poles. When you had you had Jim Harbaugh available, and he went to San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
All that guy does is win. He's controversial, but all he does is win.
So switching offensive strategy mid-season, what does that do to their prospects?
I just think it's too little too late. You've got a guy coming in now that hasn't had a whole lot of success calling plays either. So the Bears needed to look like they were doing something. And this was the head that got chopped off, was the offensive coordinator. But they don't fire the head coaches mid-season. So yeah. I think Eberflus will keep his job until the end of the season, but he's pretty much lame duck.
Carrie and I just shaking our heads here.
Well, the Bears are such like an outdated franchise.
Not outdated.
No, like they just
You're
are
right.
like archaic.
Yes.
Like they don't, with all of this talk, like we're just like they don't fire midseason. They can't get the stadium
Carrie.
Down. Like it's just not a modern way to do things.
Well,
you
here's
know?
The thing. They're about to play their arch rivals.
Yeah, Packers.
The Green Bay Packers this weekend. This is an important game, right, Mitch?
You know, a Packers game is always important.
Yes.
I think we talked about Cheryl Ray Stout. I think she said that the Bears have lost their last 10 games against the Packers.
Yes.
What?
So I think that would put the Bears' last win against the Packers pre-pandemic, which is wild to think about. And we know that the Bears ownership, the McCaskies, they put a lot of stock into Bears-Packers games, just as we fans do.
Yeah.
So if it's a particularly embarrassing loss, I don't know, maybe they will change the family tradition and fire the coach midseason. We'll see.
You know, I'm a season ticket holder and I do not want to go. I don't want to go. I don't want to be humiliated by all these cheesehead fans.
So, Mitch, having on-site sports betting, it's been an important element in the new stadium plans. And it turns out the Bears are not the only ones who want to make money off gambling. You covered a story this week, a new casino in the south suburbs.
That's right. It's the 16th casino in Illinois. There's close to 10 now, I believe, in the Chicago area, or just, you know, a half hour drive or so from downtown. This one is down in East Hazelcrest. It's the South Suburban Casino that was one of six new ones authorized back in 2019 to help fund a big infrastructure plan that Governor J.B. Pritzker has touted, you know, sort of his signature plan here. I think the big question here is how many more gambling dollars are there to be sort of wrung out of this state?
None.
There's video gaming terminals in the vast majority of suburbs. One of my favorite facts that I like to throw in stories like this is that there are more places that you can place a bet in Illinois than there are in all of Nevada.
When you factor
in the bars and restaurants with slot machines, when you factor in the 16 casinos, not to mention that we can all pull out our phone and start betting on sports right here.
Mitch, you got to pull that out of every part of you.
That is a fun fact.
That is nuts.
All right, so let me switch gears here because we just have a few minutes. And we got to touch on this, Carrie. Chicago music fans, they're mourning right now. No more Pitchfork?
No more Pitchfork Fest. Yeah, after 19 years, they announced that. Well, to be clear, and we were talking about this before we went live, no more Pitchfork in Chicago. I don't think the announcement really ruled out that it wouldn't be somewhere else, but this is so Chicago summer for many of us at Union Park.
You got fond memories?
Oh yeah, I went to the first one when it was Intonation, before it was even called Pitchfork. But you know, you almost always got rained on, and it was super muddy. You waited for the train at the Green Line. Mm-hmm. You got on a really packed bus. But in between all that, you saw really great shows. It just is it's a more intimate, smaller fest than Lollapalooza. There's always like, you know, local acts. There's this kind of more, it's not that corporate feel. There would always be like local artisans and kind of area for, you know, to support like Chirp Radio and stuff like that. So it just felt a little more homegrown.
Yeah. You know, and speaking of home, you know, Pitchfork is owned now. I mean, it started as a local
company,
a Chicago company. Now it's owned by, was it Condé Nast?
Condé Nast owns it now.
A major international company. And you just wonder if they made the decision to pull the plug. So my proposal is that Chicago Public Media should come in and sponsor a big music fest and get everybody out there and get the bands back together.
Well, we'll see how people feel about that. But I want to squeeze in one more thing. Two iconic 12-foot hot dog statues have made their way back to the
Maury
Northwest
and
side.
Maury.
After some renovations. Are any of you fans of the Superdog Drive-In?
I just was awesome. There.
Yes. Okay, Lisa Lavez has hands up in the air.
They're so good. They pack them in these little boxes and they smash the fries in there with the hot dog. And no, there's nothing like Superdog.
Awesome, awesome. Well, we'll leave it there for now. That's the weekly news recap with Carrie Shepherd of Axios, Mitchell Armitrout of the Chicago Sun-Times, and Paris Schutz of Fox 32. Gosh, where does the time go?
Madigan.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman. It was edited by Meha Ahmed and mixed by Ari Mejia. The news cycle moves fast, and our weekly news recap gives us the chance to slow it down. Now, if you enjoy our recap as much as we do, consider leaving us a rating and liking this podcast. It helps us share these stories with more people in and around the city. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.